To our second book. Do you know what? You want to know something interesting or a little fun fact that has nothing to do with our study tonight? But I was looking at the last time that we taught through Exodus, and it was almost exactly 11 years ago to the day. In May 2005 was the last time we started Exodus. Thought you wanted to know that fact? It was just about 11 years to the day. What? We've had such an exodus from Exodus, 11 years to be exact. I was kind of curious. I was kind of looking that up. And so it took about 11 years to go through the Old Testament.
Yeah.
Does that sound right?
Now I'm old.
I know. Like, I'll be dead by the time we finish the book. That's what I was thinking too. No, but you know, yeah, I want to say that because maybe there was the New Testament. Maybe it's 11 years through the whole Bible. But anyway, so if you're a faithful man, you get all of it in eventually. It was 27 or 28 studies in Genesis, so a little over two-thirds of a year maybe. But we're going to get us out of Egypt a little quicker than that. Anyway, that has nothing to do with it. But let's go before the Lord and we'll pick it up. Chapter 1. Father, again, we do ask that you'd move in our hearts and our midst tonight as we come just to hear from you, Lord. We thank you that you have preserved your word for us. And Lord, you know, it's not all ice cream and dessert, Lord. There's meat and potatoes and everything else. And some of it maybe is easier for us to go through, and maybe it's easier to read something in the New Testament or in the Gospels or something that we're more familiar with maybe. And I know there's many that kind of shy away from the Old Testament because they don't understand it, or they think they won't understand it, or it doesn't have some application to them. I know there's just a lot of that. And some of it just seems like, oh, what does that mean? And but Lord, you've preserved every word of it for us. And I thank you that my brothers and sisters see how important it is to hear the whole counsel. It's easy to pick a message here or there, or a series there and this and then that, and those are good and fine and have their place, but there's a lot more that would be skipped over if we didn't do this. And so I pray we would just continue to be faithful, and Lord, just receive all that you want to say through your word, Lord, because every bit of it is important. Every bit of it has application and meaning to us. That you're trying to tell us, or else you wouldn't have kept it there. So, Lord, I pray again you'd move by your Spirit in our hearts and our midst through your word tonight, for we ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. So, Exodus chapter 1. Well, just by way of introduction, when we start a new book, then what the Hebrews did, so remember the Old Testament written in Hebrew, New Testament written in Greek. Now, there is a little Aramaic in the Old Testament. We talked about that when we went through the book of Daniel. There was some letters. We'll see a couple places where there was a couple things in Aramaic, because that was a language, the farther we get away from, you know, Abraham and the Exodus and all that, closer we get to the New Testament. There was some influence from areas that had Aramaic as a language, but that's just a little bit. So basically, for argument's sake, Hebrew in the Old Testament, Greek in the New Testament. Well, in Jesus' day, Greek was a common language. Well, it had been that way for a few hundred years because the Greeks took over so much of the, you know, Europe and the Mediterranean and heading east and so forth. So many, one of the things that the Greeks did was they forced all the people in their realm to speak Greek. So people learned Greek. It was a very common language back then. And so when the Old Testament was coming to a close, the Jews translated the Hebrew Old Testament into Greek so that more people could read it, because not everybody could speak or read or write Hebrew at that time. You know, it had been tamped down pretty far. As a matter of fact, the Hebrew language was pretty much lost, and the Jews today in Israel speak what they call the New Hebrew. Now, that does have some similarities, obviously, to the Old Hebrew, but because they were spread out and persecuted so much, not all the old Hebrew was preserved well enough, and so they kind of made some changes. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. But it's written in Hebrew. But typically, when remember, Moses wrote the first five books. So they were all one writing, and it was so large. I think the first five books takes about 15% of the Bible. So Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, in totality, is about 15% of the Bible. So it's a pretty good chunk. And I'm sorry, this is off the top of my head. Maybe I should have wrote this down, but I didn't plan on sharing it. But I think that if you were to put the same amount of words in the New Testament, it takes about 60 some odd percent of the New Testament. So it's a big chunk. But it was written, by Moses, and not divided until later on into five different books. Although, because it was so much, they were written on five different scrolls, and that's how it became, in the Greek, the Pentateuch, speaking of five, and in the language, or the Torah, as it's called, in Hebrew. And so with Hebrew, what they would do to name their books, so they would take the first couple of words, and that's what they would call the book. But when it was translated into Greek, it was called the Book of Exodus, which means in Greek the way out, basically, or it's even referred to as the departing in Hebrews chapter 11. So that's really what it means. That's the name we have it today, and that's not really that important either. You know what some of the translators call the book, we call it today, and that's as good as anything. I like this little this little slide of it, because that's pretty much what Exodus means, the exit or moving out or the way out. You know, God's people, God had moved them down to Egypt. We've spent a lot of time talking about that the last few weeks, and now it's time to move out. So that's exactly what we're going to be talking about, and that's really the theme of the whole book, although there's so much more involved in that. But it's moving God's people back to the promised land. So from the end of chapter 11, as we'll see, it kind of picks up, I'm sorry, the end of chapter 50 in Genesis to Exodus chapter 1, and we'll see it, you know, kind of pick up there. Remember, there's some good jumps in time. Last verse, there's about 50 years, and then we'll move about 300 and some odd years into the birth of Moses. So a lot of time kind of made up in just a couple of verses there, just to move into the story of Moses, who is the one God's going to use to bring his people to the promised land. And so, you know, this is the book of deliverance, or the way out that God had given his people. One of the key words, or key themes really, in Exodus is to redeem or to set free. God's going to spend a lot of time talking about being set free, or redemption. And so we'll see that over and over again, and we'll see how that really, you know, matches up to the New Testament, and a lot of pictures of Jesus and God's plan through the Messiah. The book is also kind of divided into 40. Moses lived to be 120. And really, Moses' life is kind of broken up into three 40-year periods, and we'll see how he interacts through that. The first 40 years, he's in the palace of Egypt. The second 40 years, he's going to be in the desert of Midian, which is that takes the first two chapters, by the way, his 80 years of his life. And in the final 40 years of him being the leader of Israel and leading them out, and then, of course, the Israeli march around, death march around. So that's kind of what we're looking at of Exodus here. And again, it talks about the birth of Moses, through the Exodus, the erection of the tabernacle, and how God's people, and God ultimately wants to reveal himself, his law, his character, who he is, and that's really found in the book of Exodus. And I'll show you one more chart before we start there in verse 1 by way of introduction, but just to give you some dates on what's going on, when the chronicle of the Exodus was. So you'll see that, you know, the period of time there was prosperity, you know, with Joseph. He lived to be about 110, and the Jews, you know, it wasn't all horrible time for them. But then there was this big time of persecution it's from a pretty reputable Bible commentator, this timeline, So, you know, is it exactly this period of time? Well, I don't know if I'd bet my life on it, but it just gives you an idea. That's the idea here. So maybe 280, 300 years of persecution, and then we're going to kind of pick it up right here, that story of Exodus, and it kind of just gives you in the bottom there, and I know that one little thing's blocked out, but the plagues and God working to move the people out, then going out to Sinai, receiving the Ten Commandments, the 80-day period of time, and then also putting together God's palace or the tabernacle to worship God. So it just gives you a little bit of timeline, maybe helps you out a little bit, understand what's going on during the book of Exodus here. It kind of gives you a big picture, then this picture, this period of time is broken down into that chart down there. So this gives you a sense of where we're kind of going and how it's kind of divided up here. So that being said, let's read verse 1. It says, "Now these are the names of the children of Israel who came out of Egypt. Each man and his household came with Jacob, Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, Benjamin, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. All those who were descendants of Jacob were 70 persons, for Joseph was already in Egypt. And Joseph died, all his brothers, and all that generation. But the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly, multiplied and grew exceedingly mighty, and the land was filled with them." So again, this is the connection from the end of Genesis with Joseph here and moving into the transition of Exodus here. So there were 70 people, as we talked about last time, remember, that came out. God told him, Jacob, to go down there. He was okay, go down there. It's time. He went down there. He lived for about 17 years before he died. His dad died. And then Jacob, you remember, died. They buried him. He came back. Joseph lived for about another 54 or 5 years or something like that before he died. Saw the third generation of his children, grandchildren. And so he was there. And there was this great time there. He was very powerful. He was very influential. But then after about, in this period of time here, and it could be close to the maybe anywhere from 200 to 300 years, the Hebrews during that whole time, of course, are growing at this phenomenal rate. In chapter 12, we'll see that when they're ready to leave Egypt, Moses numbered the men, just the men, who were 20 years old and older. And that number came out to about 600,000 men. So we know that at that point, I mean, the nation just was just growing. And we'll read about that here in a little bit. Growing and growing and growing. And so I always kind of rough it out at 3 million people leaving. Probably, I personally think there was more. But that's, I look at it this way. So there were 600,000 guys, all those guys, certainly in that society, almost exclusively were married. So that gives you 1.2 million plus right off the bat, right? And then if you add each one of them having one or two children, which some of them probably had 5 or 10 or 15 children, you know, over a period of time, the older they were. But even if they just had two children, you know, that puts you, 2.5 million pretty quickly. And then we know that there's other people that we'll read about in Exodus that call the mixed multitude that went out with them as well. There were Egyptians or other races that saw God's work and they wanted to go along with them. So I think it's easily over 3 million people. So you get the idea that this was a huge group of people by the time they were leaving Egypt. So verse 8 says, "Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, 'Look, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply, and it happen, in the event of war, that they also join our enemies and fight against us, so go up out of the land.'" So now some time has gone by, and Joseph, is long gone, and there's a whole new set of pharaohs, we know from history that there's a whole new set of a dynasty of pharaohs coming in, and, they really don't know anything about Joseph. Probably few hundred years, you know, 300 years have passed. And, you know, there are big changes with that rules. And now the Hebrews, rather than being considered welcome and guests, they're at worst a threat, right? Well, man, if there's millions of these guys and somebody chooses to attack us and they decide to side on their side rather than our side, we'll be wiped out. So they think of them as a threat at worst, and at best, if something happens and they just decide to leave, we'll lose all our labor. So, you know, they're worried either one, that they'll turn against them, or two, that they'll decide to leave and then worse, all our workers. So this is what they devised to do, verse 11. And again, we don't know in that period of time of when, you know, this took place. Was it 100 years after Joseph died? Was it, you know, 50 years? Was it, you know, again, it doesn't really give us the time exactly. But this is what they decided to do in verse 11. It seems like there was a lot of them. So I tend to think it's closer to, you know, farther away from Joseph's time. But again, it doesn't give us an exact date, so I can't say anything more than that. So it says, therefore, they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with their burdens. And they built for Pharaoh supply cities, Pithom and Ramesses. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew. And they were in the dread of the children of Israel. So the Egyptians made the children of Israel serve with rigor, and they made their lives bitter with hard bondage, in mortar and brick, and in all manner of service in the field. All their service in which they made them serve was with rigor. So finally, the Egyptians decided, man, these guys are growing, and they could be a threat, or they could decide to leave. So let's do this. Let's put them under our thumb. Let's make them slaves. And, you know, and the idea, I believe, was not only to, you know, use all their strength, you know, to build and do things for them, or to take care of and farm or whatever they need to do as slaves, but so that they would be tired and they wouldn't want to rebel, they wouldn't want to leave, they'd be too weak to do anything but just get up the next day for work. And so it was pretty miserable. I mean, I don't know if that gives you some idea, but, you know, these guys literally were over them, and you need to do this and you need to do that, and these guys were slaves and they were treated very poorly, and you think you have a tough boss? Got nothing on that. You think we've had some bad bosses? These guys just, they said, you know what, we'll just keep them so low that they won't either want to turn against us or move out, and we'll lose all that labor, so let's just work them to death. Let's just literally work them so they're exhausted every day, and they got nothing to do but go home and just, you know, sleep and then get up and work them hard. There's no free time. There's no time for anything else. You could bet this was a 7-day-a-week, 12-hour-a-day, maybe more, depending on the light, job. And literally, you know, you're a slave, so you're not getting paid just enough to give you enough food so you can make it through the next day. And, but you notice that, you know, it said here in verse 12 that the more that they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew. I think there's a great spiritual lesson we need to learn here. The tougher things are, the more we tend to grow. You know, when life is pretty easy and things are going pretty well and everything is kind of on easy street and there's money in the bank and everything's okay emotionally or physically or, you know, whatever it might be, you know, we tend to just, it happens. We just kind of lose our edge spiritually. It's just something we fall into. And I think it's really true. You know, there tends to be great spiritual growth under pressure, if we allow it to. You know, some people, you know, when great pressure and difficulties come, they just, you know, they head out away from the things of the Lord, even though they might have been involved in some of the things of the Lord. And, you know, I think it either does one thing. It makes them really commit to the things of the Lord and make it serious. or they just leave it all together. And those that choose to, okay, Lord, I'm going to get serious with this. This is serious. This is my life. I realize with all these problems that, you know, I thought life was, you know, meant to be this, this, and that. And I realize that's just disappointing or didn't happen or this circumstance has changed. What I thought was going to be good turned to be this and that. And so, you know, I'm going to pour my energy and my life into things of you. And that way we see amazing growth under pressure. I mean, that's been always been true of the church. You know, when there was great persecution in the church, where it is today, you find that there's very committed Christians. They're very committed in evangelizing and telling people about Jesus. Their life is living for that and sharing their faith and serving the Lord and doing those things. But you know, the places where there's about zero persecution or zero problems, you find, you know, people will show up to church when the sun's shining and things are okay, and maybe I'll read the Bible this week or month if I, you know, if everything's okay and kids aren't bothering me and there's not a good TV show on and I can do, you know what I mean? And I think it's a great lesson. I mean, we see it here that it's a great spiritual lesson. They grew under pressure. And they did. And I think that's true. We submit ourselves to the Lord, and the Lord allows those things to come our way sometimes that we might grow. And we don't like them, but in the end, it always works out for our good. Well, to the story here, so the pressure on the outside wasn't working. They thought, well, if we just put them under a thumb, if we make them slave, we make their lives miserable, we work them to exhaustion where they can't do anything else, and that's not working, they're still growing, then the next ploy is of the enemy, as always, as well, in a spiritual sense, is to work on the inside. Right? Can't defeat them by putting pressure on the outside. Let's try to wipe them out from the inside. So that's what Pharaoh does in verse 15. Then the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, of whom the name of one was Shef. You can see her name. I can say it, but I can think it, but I can't say it. And the name of the other was Puah. Yeah, I wouldn't name your daughter that either. And she said, "When you do the and he said, "When you do the duties of a midwife for the Hebrew women, see them on the birth stools. If it is a son, then you shall kill him. But if it is a daughter, then she shall live." So the king of Egypt, the Pharaoh, now again, nothing new attacking God's people. This is nothing new, trying to wipe them out. You guys know, we've talked about it. You know, it started out with Cain killing his brother, trying to wipe out, you know, God's people, God's godly line. Here with the killing the babies, it'll be later on with nations coming in, the Assyrians and Babylonians trying to wipe them out. You know, it'll be like Esther with Haman trying to kill all the Jews. It'll be Herod in the New Testament trying to kill all the babies born around Bethlehem. It goes down to Stalin and Hitler and, you know, many other kingdoms. The Romans try to wipe out the Jews, you know, all sorts of things. Nothing new in any of this. The enemy's always trying to wipe out God's plan, God's people. But this time he's trying to do the inside job here. Having the midwives, when they're delivering the babies, either let them die or kill them in some way. And, you know, the idea is they kind of had this birthing stool, and maybe it's the point where they would let the, instead of catching the babies when they were delivered, is letting them fall and basically breaking their necks or doing something more. It's pretty, you know, it's pretty, you know, you think about it, and it's pretty troubling sounding, to say the least. So let's get one of the Hebrews, and let's get them to kill these babies. Now, again, if that sounds troubling to you, there was this article in the paper a few weeks back, and the point of that article, which is kind of hard to see in the sunlight, sorry about that, but you get the idea. It says right here in the second paragraph, it says, in the final analysis, global abortion trends since 2008, scientists have found that 56 million abortions are performed globally every year between the ages of women, the ages of 15 and 44. So lest you think that this is some horrific thing, which it was a horrific thing, don't misunderstand me, but, you know, killing babies maybe a little bit earlier than the Pharaoh was asking these two midwives to do, is nothing compared to the 56 million. And this is not a Christian thing, by the way. This is a completely secular group trying to push birth control and all these things. Okay, so it's not coming from a Christian perspective by any stretch. 56 million, they believe, is the average abortions performed globally every year. 56 million babies die. Can you imagine that? You know, if you, anyway, I won't down that road. We could. But, you know, you killed 3,000 squirrels a year, and people would go absolutely nuts. Kill 56 million babies globally a year, and the UN's not even taking that up as a problem, right? But anyway, that's the world we live in. Let's move on before I digress. But, you know, unless you think this is something strange and weird, and that's the point of this article, is that it is bad, it's evil, it's wrong, it's wicked, certainly, but not anything strange in our day and age either. And so the attack, you know, again, God's people, there's persecution on the outside didn't work, and now there's deception on the inside trying to, you know, kind of sneakily do this, you know, to these babies and to these poor moms unsuspecting. And remember, Pharaoh is arguably the most powerful man on earth at this time. Again, the Egyptian dynasties were very powerful at this time, and you know, you could argue very easily that if not the most powerful man on earth at that time, or you know, very close to it, you know, there might have been some other dynasty in some other part of the world, but certainly, you know, he was up there, and so there's a lot of pressure on these two gals to do this, and you know, to get in there and cause problems and, you know, do all this destructive work. And again, the spiritual lesson is kind of like what we've learned on Sunday morning going through 1 John, talking about John talking about how the deceivers are going to come into the church and try to lull you to sleep and speak of these doctrines and these things. And, you know, again, working from the inside. It's kind of what Pharaoh's doing, a good picture of what we've been learning spiritually on Sunday morning in 1 John as well, trying to kill him. Well, let's see what these gals do. Verse 17, but the midwives feared God. It was not much. It was a huge thing to turn your nose up on Pharaoh. Okay, just we can't underestimate or understate that enough, I don't think. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the male children alive. So the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said to them, why have you done this thing and saved the male children alive? And the midwives said to Pharaoh, well, because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are lively and give birth before the midwives come to them. Therefore God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and grew mightily. And so it was, because the midwives feared God, that he provided households for them. So these ladies would not give in to the tremendous pressure under this arguably the most powerful man in the world. They just weren't going to do it. They feared God more than they feared the most powerful man on earth. They feared God. And they said, you know, we're not going to do it. We would call this civil disobedience today. And there are many examples of this in the Bible. Again, we are never to compromise the Word of God or how it tells us how we should live our lives or how we should believe. There's just no way we're ever called to compromise that. We are told in the Bible, and there's so many places, we're told to obey the authorities over us and the governments and paying taxes and respecting those in authority over us and doing. We're called to do that. But there's always that line drawn, and there's many examples in the Bible when it starts saying, well, interfering with what God tells us to do and what the Bible directly tells us to do. Like if they said, for instance, I'm sorry, you guys can't meet together and have a Bible study. You can't have a Bible. Well, we'd say, okay, thank you very much, whoever you are that's saying that, but we know that's what God's called us to do. If somebody said, like in Daniel's day, hey, you can't pray to anybody but the king. In other words, if you got an issue or a problem, you're going to go to the government office and take care of it. You're not going to do any praying. Daniel said, thank you very much. And he went home and prayed, right? You got the idea here. We never compromise on the Word of God or what God tells us how we should live and serve and be a part of Him. Now, that being said, every time that we see that kind of, like we see here with these gals or Daniel or his three friends or, you know, the New Testament before the religious leaders or whatever it might be, you know, you don't see any big protest marches, okay? Can I just tell you that? There's not out there, we need to rally together and those protest marches when they don't like the police, you know, doing some rough things, which maybe they are, maybe they aren't, you know, I'm not saying that. But you've seen all those riots on TV, right, where they literally take over the city and they're blocking the freeways or something around here. And then they always lead to, you know, breaking stores and robbing. Okay? That's not what we're called to be as Christians, right? The civil disobedience like that is just not what you see in the Bible. What you see in the Bible, by example, is they're, you know, when someone says, hey, this, you can't do this anymore, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, you need to bow down before this idol and worship it as God, because that's my command, the king said. If not, you're going to be thrown in that fire. We're like, yeah, we're going to get all our buddies together, and we're going to protest that king's decision, and we're going to make a big... No, what did they say? King, you know, we hear what you're saying, but we know God doesn't want us to do it. And so, you know, whether we're thrown in the fire, well, God's able to save us. And even if he doesn't, well, we just can't do that because that's not what the Lord has for us. We fear God more than we fear your command or your threats. It was done with respect. It's always done with respect. It's not done with some huge emotional outburst. It's not done that way. And so again, this really ministers to me in this day and age because I read the paper. I don't really watch the news. I read the paper. I feel like I can censor it a little bit more, pick and choose what I want to read, but than watching it on TV. But, you know, I don't know about you, but I've been getting kind of worked up lately about all this, you know, the men can go into the women's bathroom and if they feel like they're girls or guys or I don't, you know, all that stuff going on, right? You know, and all this stuff that's happening. And I always kind of crack up. I go, well, if any girls tries to go into the men's room, she's going to have problems using most of the fixtures there, if you know what I mean. That's not going to work out too good anatomically. But anyway, you know, and I start getting all mad about that. And, you know, and I hear people say stuff about this and that. And it does. It makes me upset. It bothers me. It's wrong. It's evil. It's sin. Talking about that being this great crushing discrimination and, you know, equaling it to people with, you know, anyway, you know the whole stories and all the evil that's involved with all that and the pride and all the sin that's involved. And, you know, it just really starts getting to me and I start getting kind of worked up about it. And, you know, and then I'm reminded, hey, you know, Jesus told us things were going to get worse and worse and worse. They are not going to get better. They are never going to get better. They're going to go worse. People, love is going to grow cold. They're not going to love each other. There's not going to be any kind of sacrificial love. It's all going to be, what are you doing for me? What are you doing for me? You know, worse, worse, worse. Even natural love is just going to go down the tubes. And so how do we act and react? And again, this just ministered to me even this week. It's like, hey, listen, I don't have to get all worked up about this. And, you know, why are they boycotting North Carolina that wants to do things right and, you know, all this pressure and all this stuff, and that's not right. And I'm not going to go into Target because they're the first ones that came out and said anybody can use whatever bathroom you want. And then I think about my little daughter going in there, and sometimes I'm with her and I send her in there, and whether there's some creepy guy in there, you know. And I start thinking about all that stuff, and then I think, you know, something's got to be done. I think, yeah, I just got to live the life you called me to live, Lord. I can't change how the government is moving because they're going to move and they're going to get worse. But I can live a righteous and holy life. And when it comes down to saying, hey, you got to do this or I have to respect this or I have to marry two guys or two gals or something. No, it's not going to happen. I'm not going to do that. You know, I know that's what you say. I know that's what the law said, but we're not going to do it. And We do it, you know, with respect and without emotional outbursts and fearing God more than what they can do to us. And that's what these two gals did. And, you know, we're going to do what's right. Doesn't matter what anybody else says or how threatening they are, we're going to do what's right. And I don't know exactly what they did. You know, it says, hey, the women of Hebrews are a lot like the Egyptians. They go into labor and they have babies right away. And they probably did because they were slaves and they worked out hard, you know. Like some of those ladies you see in some of those third world countries that just literally have a baby out in the field, cut the cord and put the baby on their back and go back to work, you know. I'm sure they were much like that, where the Egyptians had it pretty soft. And so I don't know if the gals just kind of showed up late or they told others what to do. You know, well, I can't really be there because I'm there. Pharaoh wants me to do this, but this is what you need. I don't know what they did. Either way, whatever happened, they were blessed by the Lord for their faithfulness under pressure. Let me remind us, we'll always be blessed by the Lord for being faithful under great pressure. And verse 22, so Pharaoh commanded all his people saying, because that didn't work, every son who is born you shall cast into the river, and every daughter you shall save alive. So now it seems that Pharaoh puts every Hebrew family under pressure to do the unthinkable, which is to throw all your baby boys into the Nile River. Now, again, that sounds horrific, and it is horrific. But just keep this in mind, the same ruler who wanted to drown God's people saw his own army drowned in the Red Sea. And this ruler who wanted to kill baby boys will see his own son die as well. So in the end, he's reaping what he sowed. Keep that in mind. Now as we move into chapter 2, again, somebody might say, well, why would God allow terrible things to happen to innocent people? Here the same thing could be happening. Why would God allow children or babies to be born under such terrible conditions? Right? Don't we get those questions today? Why does God allow this? Or why is this going on? Or why is this happening? That, you know, it's a question that's not new in our time by any stretch. Because why would God allow babies to be born or children to under the terrible circumstance? You know, I think a couple things we can remember. One is this. We know the rest of the story. And, you know, and I think we can answer people in that same way. We know the rest of the story. There's nothing new. There was persecution and horrible things going on to people throughout time. And there always will be because man is basically evil. That automatically just shuts up most people because instantly they want, most people that don't know the Lord want to think that mankind is good. Good nature, and if you just peel away the layers like on an onion and you peel away a few layers, you'll eventually find something good inside. Now the Bible teaches just the opposite. The more you peel away, the more evil you'll see. And if you examine your own life, as I examine my life, like I said, sometimes I read the newspaper and I see that this person did this, or this person did this, or this person did this. And you know, the older I get, the more I can see, you know what? I am different than that, but I am capable in my natural self without the Lord. I could have committed or done or been involved in any one of those things. And I think if we're honest with ourselves, we realize, man, without the Lord, I would have or I did or I could have, I could do almost anything. You know, I was reading about that guy, I don't know what state he was in, I think it was in Florida somewhere or something, but he was going to be charged with taking bribes. It was like $7,000 or something like this. But he was taking bribes. He's on the planning commission for some city in Florida or something like that. And they found him this morning dead. And he'd taken his city vehicle or whatever it is and just drove it into a banyan tree. And he died. And I was thinking, you know, for $7,000, guy took some bribes. And who knows what he was thinking. And then now he's held up for it. He could go to prison over $7,000 or whatever. And so he just ends, you know, killing himself. And you know, honestly, I looked at it, you know, Lord, without you, I could have done something that you know, if I, who knows what, I, you know, it's only by his goodness. And so, again, you know, it's nothing new under the sun. People basically will do evil things to each other, and we can see that throughout history. But what we do is we say, Lord, we trust you. We know what you're doing, even though I may not understand or I may not know. And how do I know that? Well, because I can look back in your word and I could see where things look dark and bleak and like there was no hope and nothing was turning around. And I see how you have turned things around and how you turn things out for good. And that's your promise. And I don't know how many, you know, what that was and what that number, how that working out maybe in my life. But I can see it just like David said in Psalm 23, though, you know, I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. Lo, you're with me, you know, and you're there to guide me in your right hand, and you're going to lead me in your ways into eternity. You know, in other words, yeah, there's going to be some deep times that, Lord, you're there for me. And I don't know what you're doing, but I know you're with me, and you'll see me through. And that's a hope we can give people. And there's so much more to say to that, but I thought it would be at least good to note that. And so chapter 2 says, and a man of the house of Levi took as wife a daughter of Levi. So the woman conceived and bore a son in the middle of this horrific scene. And she saw that he was a beautiful child, and she hid him 3 months. Now, again, we get little pieces of information here in Exodus, but the Bible gives us a little bit more detail as we look in other passages. So, again, the idea was, here's what Acts, Stephen said in Acts chapter 7, verse 20 about this incident. It said, at this time Moses was born and was well pleasing to God, and he was brought up in his father's house for 3 months. So we get a little bit more here, maybe a different understanding that the idea of a beautiful child wasn't, I don't think, like, wow, what a beautiful baby. Because personally, I don't think I've met a baby that I didn't think was beautiful myself personally. So I don't think it was like he had a glow around his head, or, you know, he had these beautiful eyes or face or complexion or whatever. And, that's the idea, was that they knew something was different about him. And that's what Hebrews 11:23 says, that great chapter of faith, Hall of Faith. And Hebrews 11:23 says, by faith, Moses' parents hid him for 3 months after he was born, because they saw he was no ordinary child, and they were not afraid of the king's edict. So the great step of faith with Moses' parents here would put them in a great hall of great men and women of faith, was that they realized God had I think the idea of buying the beautiful child or this special child was that they saw and understood that God had a specific plan for this baby. You know, they knew that God had a purpose, and they did not fear what the king told them to do. They had great faith. And that's what Hebrews 11, that whole chapter, is people with great faith. And this was a great act of faith. So they realized, okay, Lord, you have a special plan. We're not going to follow what the king told us to do, the Pharaoh told us to do, by killing this baby. But that's not the end of the story. Verse 3, but when she could no longer hide him, she took an ark of bulrush for him, dabbed it with asphalt and pitch, that means made it waterproof, put the child in it, and laid it in the reeds by the riverbank. And his sister stood afar off, that's Miriam, we'll find out later on, to know what would be done with him. So we'll find out their names in chapter 6, but Moses' mother makes this waterproof baby container with a shade, we'll find out, has a lid on it, and then lets this baby go by the reeds. Now, 3 months, you realize that, you know, they're checking babies, and the baby's crying, they're going to find out it's a boy. Okay, Lord, I realize I can't keep holding on to this baby. But I know, Lord, also, this is a special baby. I know this is special. And I also know that it's time for me to let go of this baby. I realize it's time. I'm going to let him go and see what you do. Now, if you're a parent, you know that every parent has or will face this day, similar day someday, where they have to let their children go. Not usually this early, though, of course, thankfully. But, you know, that's where she was. This is that great step of faith where she said, okay, Lord, I know this is the baby. I know you have a special purpose, but I know I can't keep him any longer. So I'm going to put them in this basket, and I'm going to trust you that because you do have a plan that you're going to do a great thing. And sometimes we just have to let go and trust the Lord will take care of everything. Sometimes we just have to let go and trust the Lord that He is going to take care of everything. And just like Jochebed here, his mom, you know, we can't control the circumstances. We don't know all the situations and the detail. We can't control any of that. I know the Lord wants to do a work, so I'm going to let go and trust you, Lord. And that's exactly where these parents were. I got to let go and trust you. Can't do it on my own. I can't work it out. I know it's time, and I'm going to trust you. It's a great place when we come into our lives where we just finally say, you know what, I'm letting go of my logic and my thinking or my feelings or my emotions, and I'm just going to trust you, Lord. I was actually thinking about that today. It sounds like I was doing a lot of thinking today. I think I actually was, for once. but really, I was thinking, you know, all the things and the heartaches and problems I've caused myself over the years because, you know, I just, and they weren't necessarily bad motives. Don't misunderstand me. But, you know, if I had to just trust God more instead of trying to work things out and do things and help Him along and make things work out rather than letting Him do things and realizing, you know, you're trying to control these circumstances, but you can't control these circumstances. You have to trust me. I think I would have spared myself so many years of heartache on certain things and different situations. And I think, you know, Moses' parents realized, Lord, you have a plan. This baby, it's yours. You gave them to me. You have a plan. I'm going to trust you with it. Let's see what you do. Let's see what you do. And I'm just going to trust you. I'm not going to try to manipulate or work out or do. I'm going to trust you. I think I would have lived, had probably a lot more hair if I had done that, maybe. I don't know. Anyway, verse 5. Let's see what happens. Then the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river, and her maidens walked along the riverside. And when they saw the ark in the reeds, she sent her maid to get it. And when she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the baby wept. So she had compassion on him and said, "This is one of the Hebrews' children." So again, while other babies at that time went to be with the Lord, this one went to be with Pharaoh's daughter. And the Lord used her natural nurturing heart as a woman, hearing this baby cry, seeing the basket there, and then seeing the baby crying in the basket, realizing, you know, her dad had put a death sentence on these babies, her heart went out and gave her this yearning for Moses to move Moses into the place that God had for him. She trusted. Miriam's going along to follow and sees what's going on, moving Moses right into the place God had a design and plan for him. Well, verse 7, then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Well, shall I go and call a nurse for you from the Hebrew woman, that she may nurse the child for you?" And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go." So the maiden went and called the child's mother. Then Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages." So the woman took the child and nursed him. And the child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. So she called his name Moses, or Moses, saying, "Because I drew him out of the water." And that's to draw out. That's what the name Moses means. So the Lord works it all out so that Moses' mom gets a paycheck now from Pharaoh's daughter for taking care of her own son. So Miriam runs up to Pharaoh's daughter, sees the baby in her hand, sees her little baby brother. "Hey, Pharaoh's daughter, can I get you someone to take care of that, to nurse that baby, you know, until he's, you know, weaned or grown up a little bit?" "Oh, sure, yeah, that'd be a great idea." Hey, "I'll be right back." Grabs her mom, brings her over. "Hey, take care of this baby, I'll pay you." And then, you know, when he's weaned, in that day and age, it probably was 3 or 4 years old. The idea is when he wasn't such a little guy, you know, a baby to take care of. He was more of a toddler, a little older than that maybe, that she brought him back to him. And again, that's God working and moving in this whole situation there. Now, from this sentence in verse 10 to verse 11, there is nothing said about the first 40 years of Moses' life. We don't get any details here in Egypt, I'm sorry, in Exodus, what was going on in Egypt with Moses during those first 40 years. But back to the New Testament, in the book of Acts chapter 7, we get a little bit of information about what Moses did during his 40 years. And it says in Acts 7:22 that Moses was educated in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was powerful in speech and action. So in other words, it would be kind of like this. You hear all the horrible things going on in Haiti, that very poor, one of the poorest countries in the world, Haiti, that island down in the Caribbean down there. So imagine like taking a little baby down there and one of President Obama's daughters adopts one and it becomes that baby's son, her son. So you know what would happen if they were going to pick it up? They would take, you know, Air Force One or one of the presidential jets or some big down there private jet. They would land on the island. They would put the baby in there, or in this case, a little, you know, now he's 3 or 4 years old, and back, you know, he'd be educated at the prestigious boarding schools that, you know, the most powerful man in the world, you know, educates his children, access to the greatest universities, and has everything at his fingertips. That was Moses. That was Moses. He had everything. He had access to the best of everything in the world at that time, educationally, and in every other way. Just think of him as being like, you know, the president's children or Bill Gates' kids or something like that. You get the idea. You know, keep this in mind, because the child, you know, the teen, the adult, had it made in every way through Moses' stage. You know, growing up as a child, getting into a teenager, and then a young adult, and then an adult. He had everything on a silver platter, the best of everything. Now, verse 11 says, "It came to pass in those days, when Moses was grown, that he went out to his brethren and looked at their burdens." Now, verse 11 is really interesting to me because, again, we get very little information about Moses, and we'll know in a minute that he's 40 years old. We'll find that fact out. But we get very little information about how Moses knew that he was even a Hebrew or what was told him. Because remember, he had the finest of everything. He was treated with royalty. He wasn't just like, you know, this, you know, throw in there. He had it all. A couple things strike me here, and I think it's important that we know. First of all, it seems that even though Moses' family only had a few years to raise him, and let's say he was 3 or 4, and I think that's a pretty good case. You know, they really were used by the Lord to reach Moses' heart about the plan God had for him. Hey, Moses, you're a special boy. God's got a plan for you. God wants to do great and wonderful things in your life. You know, Lord's got a calling on you. Don't forget. Don't forget you're one of us. You're a Hebrew. You're a Jew. God's got a plan for that. And I believe that we see here just in this one verse, because we don't know of any other contact that he had with slaves, which him being, you know, in the palace and dealing with slaves was probably very far removed from that. But you know, again, I think there's much to be said about Moses' parents here just telling him, encouraging him, and reminding him, you know, God's got a great plan for you. God wants to do wonderful things. You know, he's got great plans. And I think don't underestimate the influence that you and I have in certainly in our children's life, no matter what age they are, but certainly in other people's lives. We have an influence. Don't remind them. Remind them, you know, they're special to the Lord, and God's got planned for them. There's so much we can encourage people. That's what Moses' family certainly did. You know, because he looks out and realizes, hey, Lord, you have great plans for me, and here I am. I got the best of everything, but I'm not in the center of your will. As a matter of fact, this is what Hebrews 11 says about Moses during this time. It says, "By faith, Moses, when he had grown up, he refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He chose to be mistreated along with the people of God rather than enjoy the pleasures of sin for a short time.
He regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as of greater value than the treasures of Egypt, because he was looking ahead to his reward. So in other words, you know, what it's saying is here is that, you know, he didn't run from the call of God in his life. He realized, I'm going to grab it. And I realized I have everything here and I could live my life out in wonderful ease. But I realized that's empty. And I realized it's what I'm going to gain eternally is not comparable to anything I give up in this world. And I think, can you imagine what kind of Christians and Christian life we can live if we really apply that to our lives? Is that, you know what, whatever I choose not to do or have or be or get for your sake, Lord, is nothing compared to what giving up that compared to what I'm going to get from you. And I think that just kind of revolutionizes our life when we realize there's just nothing I'm giving up or when staying faithful or obedient to your word and your calling that you won't ultimately multiply and give me back a million times over, you know, in eternal rewards or just being with you in eternity. And he didn't run from God's call on his life. But that doesn't mean he didn't have some lessons to learn. Let's read the rest of that. And he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. So he looked this way and that way. And when he saw no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. And when he went out on the second day, behold, two Hebrew men were fighting. And he said to one who did the wrong, why are you striking your companion? And then he said, well, who made you prince and a judge over us? Do you intend to kill me as you killed the Egyptian? So Moses feared and said, surely this thing is known. Now, again, there's important lessons to learn right here. First of all, again, Moses had it all. He had this life of ease, and he could have done the minimum and just skated and you know, would have had a life of ease. But he didn't run from God's call on his life. And second, we see here that he wasn't doing it, though, the way he realized I want to serve you. I don't want to be in the world and involved in all this stuff with Egypt. I want to be separated with you and your people. And so he decides to do that. But Moses is now stepping out on his own way and doing his own thing in the sense that, you know, and doing it in his own timing. Again, people do the same thing today. Let me give you an example. You know, people have a passion or they see something wrong and they just want to leap. Like, I feel I need to say this or do this or go there. And they don't take the time to seek God's way of doing it or God's timing in doing it. Because both are important. We need not only God's way of doing it, we need to do it God's way, but we also have to do it in God's timing. You need to know, and how do I know this? Well, first of all, when Moses killed the Egyptian for beating that Hebrew slave, what did he do? It said, he looked to the left, he looked to the right. Is anybody looking? Okay, nobody's looking. Nobody saw that I killed this guy. Okay, let's quit. I'm going to bury him in the sand. That I'll tell you something right there. He looked to the left and to the right, but he didn't look up, right? He looked to the left and right. Is anybody watching me? Can I do this? Okay, I'm getting away with it, no problem. He didn't. He didn't look up. Hey, God, is this the way you want me to do it? And, you know, again, Moses sought in the energy of the flesh to fulfill God's purposes. And the Lord never wants us to do that. He wants us to live by the Spirit and follow the Spirit, not to do it in our own strength. Because you see, Moses couldn't keep buried in the sand one Egyptian, but when he was doing it God's way, being led by God and God's timing, he buried the whole Egyptian army under the Red Sea. When he's doing it his way and his time, he couldn't even hide the death of one Egyptian. But we'll find out not too many chapters hence, the whole army was buried when he was doing it God's way, because that's what God intended to do. It's important. Know God's time. Do it God's way. Don't run off on passion or emotion. Always run under the filter of God. Is this what you want me to do? Is this the time you want me to do it? And how do you want me to do it? You've given me this burden, this passion. Now, how do you want me to do it? And when do you want me to do it? Just as important as doing it. Well, how do you think that went over with Pharaoh? Verse 15, when Pharaoh heard the matter, he sought to kill Moses, but Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. Now imagine you're Moses. That must have been a huge, depressing, long walk. I can't imagine feeling too much worse than this. Here you are. You're the prince in Egypt. You have everything. Everything's given to you. Everything's respected to you. Everybody respects you. You have all this. You have this power, authority, this wisdom, this and that. And then all of a sudden you try to do this, and now you have nothing, and you're wanted, and they want to kill you, and you're leaving, and the people that you wanted to help aren't helping you. Let's read the rest of what Acts says about this. And when Moses was 40 years old, he decided to visit his fellow Israelites. And he saw one of them being mistreated by an Egyptian, so he went to his defense and avenged him by killing the Egyptian. And Moses thought that his own people would realize that God was using him to rescue them, but they did not. So we get a little insight here in the New Testament that, you know, Moses is thinking, hey, you know, here I am. I'm Moses, you know. I'm Moses. And I'm trying to help you guys who ratted me out, we'd say today, right? Who ratted on me? Why would they do that to me? Can you imagine these questions going over as he's running for his life out in the desert? Didn't they know that I was the guy? I had the power. I remember Moses did. I had the power to make their lives better. I'm the prince in Egypt. I had the connections. I knew the right people to turn this thing around. I was in the right place, yet they rejected me. But you see, it wasn't the education that Moses had that the Lord wanted. It wasn't Moses' position that the Lord wanted or wanted to use. It wasn't the power Moses had that the Father needed. It wasn't any of that stuff. Moses didn't understand that yet. He didn't need his position. He didn't need his education. He didn't need his wealth. He didn't need his place where he was there. He wanted to use Moses, led by his Spirit, doing it his way in his time. And so the Lord now is allowing and leading Moses outside of Egypt for 40 years. And he'll spend 40 years in the desert before he could use him, because he had to get Egypt and all that stuff out of Moses. And remember when we were going through Genesis, and we'll finish up here in a minute. Remember going through Genesis, and remember when Joseph said to his brothers and his dad, hey, when you go see Pharaoh, tell him you're Egyptian, but just don't forget that to the Egyptians, a shepherd is detestable. That's like the low life. It's the lowest job that you could possibly hold in Egypt, and they were just considered the lowest life people. So just know that when you tell them you're a shepherd, you're considered a low life in Egyptian society. And guess what God had Moses doing for 40 years in the desert? He was a shepherd. Because God needed to use the man and not all that he had or he thought that he had. And so now he's out in the desert. And let's finish this up quickly here. Now, the priest of Midian had seven daughters. So he's made it out to the wilderness area. It's kind of Mount Sinai area that we'll find out later on. And they came and drew water, and they filled the troughs to water their flock. And the shepherds came and drove them away, but Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flock. And they came to Reuel, their father, and he said, how is it that you have come so soon today? And they said, well, an Egyptian delivered us from the hand of the shepherds, and he also drew water for us and watered our flock. So he said to his daughters, well, where is he? Why is it that you have not left? Why is it that you have left the man? Call him that he may eat bread. So he had seven daughters, and obviously in this place, ladies didn't go first. These ladies would go out to water their flocks, and then all of a sudden these guys would come in with their flocks and saying, good, they filled the trough, we're going to drink all the water. And so these poor girls were probably having it pretty tough. Then they would have to let those guys go and fill them up again, and so it took them a lot longer. And all of a sudden they're home early one day. Wait a minute, what are you guys doing here? And, well, this guy helped us out, man. They were trying to take our water. He stood up for us. And he probably, you know, he looked like an Egyptian. He just came from Egypt, obviously. They thought he was an Egyptian. And he helped us out and defended us and helped us even water our flock. And Pop says, invite that guy for dinner. That's what Annabelle's parents, when they said when they saw me. No, I'm just kidding. This guy's a prize. That's the way we'd say it today, right? That's what his dad's thinking. And verse 21, then Moses was content. You guys didn't laugh at that joke because he thought it was serious. I'm just kidding. Then Moses was content to live with a man, and he gave Zipporah, his daughter, to Moses. And she bore him a son and called his name Gershom. For he said, I have been a stranger in a foreign land. That's what Gershom means. And now it happened in the process of time that the king of Egypt died. Then the children of Israel groaned because of their bondage, and they cried out, and their cry came up to God because of their bondage. So God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. And God looked upon the children of Israel, and God acknowledged them. Now don't get the idea here that the Lord was too busy someplace else and was busy over on the other part of the world, and all of a sudden hearing all this complaining and crying because of the slave drivers and the terrible things they were doing, and, oh man, I totally forgot about those guys. Don't get that idea. But what the thinking here is, again, no, now it's the right time to bring my people to the promised land. It's the right time, it's the perfect time, just like the Lord does. In the right time, he's going to bring everything together, all those problems and difficulties. We trust him in the right time. Okay, now it's time to act. Now it's time to move. Now it's time to bring my people out into the promised land. And we'll see that next week as well. Father, we thank you for this time, Lord, that we get to look at these wonderful things that you have recorded for our learning, so we might know and grow closer to you in faith and in trust, Lord. Help us to be those people, Father, for we ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen.